Well, he actually came to me many a long year ago and asked me how to work on television.
Juan Tamariz?
Yeah. He knew his close-up and possibly his theatre scene, but he had no concept of how to work on television. And it was interesting, one night I'm sitting at home and the phone rang.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. This week we finish our chat with international magic superstar Paul Daniels. He was quite influential in Great Britain at the close of the 20th century, and not just as a role model for magicians. As mentioned in the previous podcast, according to one of the national newspapers in England, Paul was the most recognized figure in Great Britain, second only to Prince Charles. At 76 years of age, Paul has only slowed down a bit. He is disposing of his vast magic collection, but still writes, produces, and performs a touring show each year throughout the UK along with his lovely wife, Debbie McGee. In this podcast, we move from his television years and on to other more current activities, including his touring show, the accident when he cut off the tip of his finger, the magic circle, and his recent legacy put out in a 4-disc DVD set called Bravura. So, let me again step aside as we resume our talk with Paul Daniels. In your collection, do you have a particular thing that you like to collect, or just kind of like Jay Marshall, I want it all?
Oh, Jay, bless him. Jay Marshall was the reason you keep pulling all these stories out of Fectors. Because I did my thing, and then I did any questions, you know, and now call Q&A. And Jay said, tell him about so-and-so.
Yeah.
And I said, well, that's nothing to do with magic. No, tell him. Because I've got a head that remembers every damn comedy act I ever saw, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I told him about this dead English comic. And as I finished, he said, tell him about someone. And by now I'm starting to overrun by the time I get to the third comic he wants me to talk about. And so I looked at Obi, and Obi went, oh, this is great, keep going. And Obi actually cancelled one of the speakers. And then in the bar that night, everybody's asking me, so Obi put me on again the next day. I kind of talked comedy for 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of which, they gave me an award, which I've still got somewhere floating around here. It's in a shelter. And it says, the funniest man in the world. And I said, hey, I'm only accepting this on behalf of British comedy, because you haven't heard my acts. You've been listening to other guys' acts. They're all dead. So
there were several things I remember from that particular time when you were there, and I had performed and I did something. It was Jumping Gemini of Darwin Ortiz's routine, I believe. And in doing that, there was something that the cards got out of sequence, and I redid it. I remember that you were sitting in the front row, and then when you were talking, you kind of looked across and said, you just need to start over. You know, when something happens and goes wrong, you just need to stop and start over. You know, no apologies, and just kind of move forward and do it
paint,
again.
It's, if you can't hide it, paint it red.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it.
And it was another thing, a tip that I still use today, and that is of how that you stick the microphone through the knot in your tie. So this way that the microphone is pointing down, but it's still near your mouth.
And it gets rid of the pop.
Exactly. Rhythm. It won't pop, and the cords aren't showing.
That's right. It looks neat.
Yeah, I just think that's a great tip. I just was using that last week in a show that someone had provided the microphone, and I was using that, and I was telling them, and they said, oh, that's a good idea. I said, yep, comes from Paul Daniels.
Also, but, in the back of my shirts, when I was using that kind of microphone, I would have a little pocket between my shoulder blades, so the pack didn't stick out, you know, too much.
Yeah.
Incidentally, on your video on YouTube, you do an amazing trick. Wow, man, is that a good trick. You're tying up your wife legally.
Yes.
And there's a guy standing watching you.
Right.
And on the insert in the bottom left-hand corner, that man is a completely different color. I don't know. How the hell do you do that? Anyway.
Good point. You know, I once had a client who said, You know, I had to watch that three times because I didn't understand what was happening. And he said it was finally that my secretary said, well, you know, the guy's jacket came off, you know, because I guess he was watching the split screen also and seeing which one am I supposed to watch. Or
yeah.
But as far as the collection goes, have you pretty much disposed of everything, or you haven't been selling it off in a lot? It's just been like one thing at a time.
There seems to be a lot of posters here that I want to get rid of. Yeah. I've got stuff. One of the best things was, I went up to, there was a comedy magician, I think just a semi-pro, but very popular, Tom Harris. That was it. Used to dress as a schoolmaster, English style, you know, and used to knock hell out of the kids. He got on the stage really good. All the things we've always wanted to do to those kids. He bashed them, yeah. And so when he passed away, his son came on to me and said, I've got this chair. And I said, oh, yeah. And he said, and it used to belong to a guy called Louis Hoffman. And I stayed cool, and I said, really? And he said, yes, it's a Burmese teak, totally engraved chair, but as was very much in the vogue in those days, had his initials carved into it, you know, LH. Yeah. So how much do you want for it? We did the deal. I drove up to pick it up. It's still upstairs in the house here. And it's for sale. Make me an offer. And so, but he said, oh, and there's this box of rubbish. And I rummaged in the box of rubbish. And I said, well, I'll give you £50 for it. Because in the bottom of the rubbish was a Robert Houdin clock.
Wow.
But it's the one with the little Turk standing behind a table with three cups and three sets of balls, you know? And it wasn't working. My father, who's a great craftsman, worked on it, got it to work, and then I took it to Garrard's, the Royal Jewelers, and their craftsman really went to work on it and refurbished it completely. But the clothing on the Turk was rotting. And so they went to the Victoria and Albert Museum and got some material from the 1860s and remade a costume for him from original material. Yeah.
Wow, that's pretty cool. Yeah. You were talking about doing the children's shows and how he'd really kind of move him around. Reminds me, you know, Terry Seabrook telling me once where he'd put a thumbtack in a book when he would kind of swat the child and he would make him jump because of the thumbtack.
I learned early on, if you get a really bad kid, you get him on stage and you give him a wand and tend to lift him in the air. And if the kid starts crying, you say, no, don't do that. Now they do. Oh, well, it's obviously too embarrassing here for you. Come on, let's give him a big round of applause. And you send him back to his seat. Well, every time you lift the wand up in the air, you look at it as it goes up, but you stand on the kid's foot. And the kid cries. This is all good stuff here, folks. And then give him a big round of applause. And as they're giving them the round of applause, you say in his ear, "You make one more noise, and you'll get worse than that." I never had much trouble with kids.
Yeah,
I did one time. Yeah, I had one kid. I don't do children's parties much, but I got a request that you really can't turn down, and I did a royal party. And one kid was being a little sod, and so I got him up on the stage and picked him up by the lapels, right off the feet kicking, you know. I said to him, "Now look, son, one day you're going to be King of England, and then you can have my head chopped off. But in the meantime, you will sit down, you will shut up, and you will be good, because this is not your party, and you're not going to spoil it for anybody else. Nobody had ever talked to Prince William like that. And he went and sat down and was as good as gold.
Wow. And nobody chastised you or said anything afterwards, or you shouldn't have touched?
Behind his back was an adult princess giving me a big thumbs up.
Wow. That could have gone either way. But, you know, speaking also then of history, I want to talk a little bit about Max Mellini, because you worked at the French Festival, doing Max Mellini. Was Max someone who had inspired you early on? I mean, he kind of did small things, I guess, like chop cup and cups and balls and whatnot, and was an entertainer that was very well known and performed for royalty. What was it that, was it all those things and more that inspired you to do a recreation of him?
Well, first of all, nobody kind of inspired me or anything. I just taught myself for 10 years. Mm-hmm. I didn't know there were other magicians on the planet. I read books. I still do. Books were it. But of course, in the reading of all the books, you keep coming across this character called Mellini. And you may know or you may not know, I'm pretty good with the classic force of a card. And, for example, I've just been teaching it and, amongst a group of magicians, and one magician said, "What happens if you miss?" And Debbie said, "Well, I've been with him 30 years, and I'm waiting to find out."
That's pretty darn good.
I'm pretty good. Well, I had a little book come out on magic stuff, and we went to launch it. And there's all these press men there and press ladies. And the publisher said, "Well, now we're going to have a question or two, and then Paul is going to show you some tricks." Unfortunately, nobody had mentioned this before, but I always have a pack of cards in my pocket. And I went into this routine of going around the audience saying, "Now, look, I've got to do this very quickly. Just pick a card, any card, but don't let anybody else see it. Look at it. See it. We'll just get it fixed in your mind and then put it back in the pack anywhere. We'll shuffle them up and we move on over here. Now, what I want you to do is take any card and do the same thing as she did." And I did about 20 of these people. And I said, "Now, the impossibility trick. I am going to now name the cards one at a time. And when I name the card, you all shout, you must stand up and shout, 'That's mine.'" And, of course, I name one card, and the whole gang of them stand up and shout, "That's mine." It's a funny bit. But it must be delivered at speed, it must be done with power, or it becomes bloody boring when they go to pick a card.
Yeah.
So, in the audience was Barry Murray, the gentleman I talked about, a good researcher and all that. And he came to me afterwards, and he said, "Was that all classic force?" And I said, "Yes." "Hell," he said, "I didn't know you could do that." And I said, "Well, it's my biggest weapon, you know, in card magic. It puts me way ahead of the game every time." And so he said, "I've got these notes." And he came round, and in the old days, magicians used to employ people to get employment with another magician. And then report back as to what they were doing and how they were doing it.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, I've read about this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so a Keller or a Thurston or a somebody employed a man to get a job with Max Mellini as his road manager, advanced salesman, whatever.
Yeah.
And he had written the full show out with a lot of the hows and the whys. The house, back to this American magician. And Barry Murray has a copy of it. And so I read it and went through it, and there's one little word in it somewhere in there that says, "I don't know why he bothers doing this trick." Okay. And as a working pro, I went, "Well, I do." And the old one of the second trick in the Mellini show was classic forces. of the Queen of Hearts. And so when I was asked to do a secondary show up in Edinburgh, which is a phenomenal festival of drama and music and comedy and puppetry and everything, it is phenomenal. To give you an example of that, on any one day, our box office was up against 2,300 other shows.
Wow.
That's wow. What's going on in town. We, Debbie and I went to see a murder play and it was held in a gent's toilet. Everywhere, everywhere is a venue. There's shows in taxis. It's extraordinary. And I did this Malini show. And I know there was one professional magician from the UK who came to see it and was sitting next to my manager. And after the show, my manager said, would you like to come and say hello to Paul? And he said, no, I got to go away and think. I didn't know he could do this stuff. When they say magic is the art that disguises its arts, and I've used the plural there. I think I've developed it.
Yeah, I know that the Fringe Festival has, as you say, thousands of other shows and lots of competition. And so did you do that for two different seasons or just the one?
I've been twice. Yeah, twice. I've been twice. Mm-hmm. The vast majority of shows there lose money.
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
No, yeah, you can lose a fortune. But everybody, it's the dream scene. Everybody's hoping some TV producer will spot them and that's why they all go.
That's the reason why. Okay, I just thought it was something kind of like a Renaissance festival that everybody kind of wanted to go and do something. I didn't know necessarily that there was an end game, that they were doing this with the hopes of getting something else.
In my case, and in a few other guys' cases, we go because we just love it. It's phenomenal. There's nothing else like it. And the venue we were in last time, I think there were 10 other shows on that day in that venue. We were getting, there was no dressing rooms, it was in a lecture hall, and we were getting changed in the next lecture hall between the rows of seats. It's just wonderful madness, yeah.
And did you take on the character of Max Malini, or do you just talk about him?
I talk about Max Malini, and to show how crazy and wacko I am, I actually flew to Australia to meet the only person living then that I knew had talked with and met with Max, mm-hmm. to see if I could get the voice right. And yeah. You might have heard of her. Her name is Moyo Miller.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. She worked with a lot of people. A lot of the greats. When you say get the voice right, I've heard that he had quite a thick Austrian accent, I guess. Is that right?
Yeah. When he's speaking and destroying, and a lot of people say, well, why didn't he have the American accent, you know, talk down his nose? Mm-hmm. But the reason for that is, have you gone online and listened to Houdini?
I have.
In the Smithsonian? Mm-hmm. You know, those tapes?
Yes.
You will notice something. His accent is not American. It's English. There's no hint there. And if you watch early American movies, it's very English accent. I would suggest that if you go through the 50s, you start to hear the American accent getting to what it is today. And it's extraordinary how it's changed. So by the same token, when Max was doing his accent, he was not guttural speaking American. He was guttural speaking English. But it was very, very, very harsh. It kills your throat. You do it.
I was going to say, kind of guttural, and this was, what, an hour show? I would imagine by the end that you
needed to... Yeah, but no, I broke it up. But what was interesting for me as an actor, which I have done a bit of, I think it would be about week two or three, I started to feel Malini. You know, it was really weird. I was doing tricks, and I knew this is exactly how he was doing them, you know.
You sound like Daniel Day-Lewis, you know, get into the part such that you actually become the part.
Yeah, and that is it, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's the other thing about acting, of course, it's always the first time you've said the words. But that applies to us because we are actors upon the stage playing the part of magicians. And so we act. And
yeah.
We act surprised and we act, you know, and we tell lies.
and have people believe them, exactly. You know, you did a lot of research, I'm sure, on Max Mellini, and help me if you can. I had written an article many years ago, and I had researched and found that he was a member of the Friars Club in New York City, and I had published that. Well, years passed, and I got a phone call from Steve Cohen, who's doing, of course, the Chamber of Magic in New York City, Ritz-Carlton.
I know, Steve.
Okay, so anyhow, Steve called to say, where did you get that information? I've researched and been trying to find something in the records because he said I would like to know more about it, about magicians who belong there. And I went back and I could not find that. Is that a fact? Have you heard that or do you know whether or not?
I've never heard that. The guy to ask is Ben Robinson.
Oh, good idea. Okay. I'll check with him.
Ben's good about Mellini and also, and in fact gave me a copy of, the pen that Mellini used to use for getting a note into things. Yeah, right.
Well, I was also going to ask you about the Magic Circle, which you've been a member of for a long number of years then.
A long time, yes, my son, yes. a long time, yes.
And you had run for president, as I recall, and you were up against David Berglas, I think, who actually won. Was that the timing?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's at the time, yeah.
Yeah, and you're still involved, but not in a political way. I guess you really haven't run for office in a while.
No, well, I don't understand politics in magic.
There seems to be a lot of it, even at the local levels.
Yeah, they don't seem to be as interested in performance as I am. Mm-hmm. And this applies worldwide to magic clubs. In fact, I consider the lucky, if you think lucky, I was... The first thing that happened when I came out of the army and I had been studying magic and I was a young man. And as we all know, I speak now to all you young guys. I know full well that you know everything. And you know everything about magic. And that's what I was. And then I saw a little lecture advertised on the history of magic and a guy did a trick there. His name was Hebblethwaite, Dr. Hebblethwaite, and he did a trick, and I hadn't a clue how the hell he did it. And I talked to him afterwards, and he said, well, if you're really interested, you should join the Middlesbrough Circle of Magicians, which was the club in my town. And I didn't even know that existed. And so I applied. I had to audition. And then they did a wonderful thing. They don't tell you straight away you're a member. You wait a month while they decide. Mm-hmm. And that makes it very special when that letter comes and says you've been accepted as a member. Rather than just pay the fee you're in, you know?
Yeah.
And they also had a competition that ran across 6 months, the second Monday of every month.
Okay.
And early on, the committee would decide what those performances were to be about. In other words, the first competition, month one, might be about silk magic. Mm-hmm. The second one would be liquid magic. The third one would be spherical objects, balls to you. And so on. A trick from a magazine or a book, and you had to bring the magazine or the book along to show you'd done it. Mental magic. And you got 6 points if you won, you got 4 points if you came second, you got 2 points if you came third, and you got 1 point if you joined in.
Okay.
And everybody used to join in.
Sure.
You know?
Sure.
What I didn't realize then was that competition was really getting me ready for magic in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
I can do illusions, I can do mentalism, I can do card sleights, I can do coin magic, I can do liquid magic. In other words, it was getting me ready for television. And the vast range I was called upon to perform.
And that was your goal? Were you shooting for that, or did it just kind of...
No, I just wanted a good magician.
Yeah.
And when the young, particularly today, the young start doing dynamo shuffles and all mm-hmm. that, I mm-hmm. said, well, that's very good, but now show me a trick.
Right.
You're
a good juggler, now show me a trick. Yeah.
I like Dino. He's a good guy. But some of the stuff now, all they're focused on is juggling packs of cards. And they're missing so much in this wonderful hobby of other stuff. My parallel is if I go to buy a car, the guy in the Ford garage doesn't say, we've got this one car.
Yeah.
He offers me a range. So if a corporate job comes to me, as they did one time, and say, can you make a JCB, that's like the equivalent of your caterpillar, excavator appear, I just say yes.
Mm-hmm.
And then I worry about it later. but I did make a JCB excavator appear, you know.
Yeah.
I can do that. If you've only got cards in your hands, well, I'm sorry, lad, but you won't be earning the money that is out there.
The magic world is so much larger, you know, that is out there that's beyond just close up and staged, you know, with livestock and mentalism and escapes, et cetera, et cetera.
It's limitless. I mean, yeah. You know, and if you do it all, you have far more fun than the boring repetition every night of the same damn card trick.
Well, and I think also that you bring in a lot of aspects of these other things that come to bear on a specific thing. In other words, that by knowing about black art as it applies to illusions can also be used in a close up situation.
Indeed, it can.
Thumb tips being used on stage, you know?
Yeah, well, I use a thumb tip all the time.
Yeah.
And I have to. I cut a bit of my finger off. And yeah. I find that if I put the thumb tip on, I can still touch type. Anyway, so it's, but also what happens is if you are good with a pack of cards, you will handle illusions better.
Mm-hmm.
If you are good with illusions, you will stage, as it were, even in close-up terms, you will stage your magic with cards in a better way.
Right.
They all cross over. The theatricality
crosses over. Right, right. Speaking of that, I was going to get around to talking about a couple of years ago when you did have an accident and you cut off a bit of your fingers. Were you working, building something in the Illusion Workshop, as I recall, or to go?
Yeah, I was actually in the workshop, but what I was actually building was a safety device for the saw.
Hmm.
Ironic or
what? Ironic, yeah.
Yeah, and it was January the 1st, early morning. Debbie was working because Debbie does her own radio show. And you know what a pusher is? You when you're using a table saw, you never use your hands to put the
wood
through.
Oh, yes.
Pusher. It snapped. And the impetus took my hand into the saw and took the top off my third finger of my left hand. But in January the 1st, an early morning, I slapped my hand against my chest, ran for the car, and drove myself to the hospital. Gushing blood, darling. Gushing.
Yes. Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah.
Was it like down to the first knuckle, or how far down did you?
Yeah, down the first knuckle. I took the top piece off. But it's interesting. You don't realize just how much you use every little bit of every finger.
Mm-hmm.
And I was fortunate. I got a phenomenal hand surgeon, really good. And I was talking to him about it, and he said, "You know, the one finger you really don't want to lose." And I said, "What?" This is your little finger.
I would have guessed the thumb.
Yeah, everybody says the thumb. He says, no, the little finger. Just notice how much you grip things with your little finger.
Yeah.
It's true. You get hold of everything. When you pick it up with your little finger. And you can close your other fingers around in the palm without the thumb being there. But the little finger going. But as a card magician, just losing that one tip, it was extraordinary because you just feel like you've got a hole in everything. When you pick things mm-hmm. up, it's a hole in it. And it was really good. What was really good, nobody knew what had quite happened. The first person, how the hell he found out, I don't know. But the very first person, straight on the phone to see if there's anything he could do, and that was Teller.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. All the way from over here.
Yeah. And then, of course, May Yedid.
Yeah.
And then Luis de Matos sent me sent me a book by a very famous gentleman on how to do magic with one arm.
René.
Yeah, René Lamont. And so, and incidentally, some of those moves are easier with one hand.
When you're not having to fumble with your other one.
Yeah, it's really good.
Now, do you have nerve endings at the at now your fingertip there? Or
yeah, I was offered a prosthetic, and they can make prosthetics over here, and must be over your place too.
Sure.
That are so good, you really can't tell.
Yeah.
But you can't feel anything with them.
Yeah, interesting.
So I've just had the end of my finger sealed over, and only one person has ever noticed that it's gone when I've been working, and that was a South Korean. And as I am not going to do much work over there, I'm not worried about the rest of them seeing it.
Are most of your shows close-up or stand-up, stage?
No. The last show had Illusion. Debbie was performing Giant Cut Tricks. We did a new design sub-trunk that I designed. We did a Levitation Rule, the lot. But because every year I change the show completely, the show that will go out this year, I mean, last year's show was called Back Despite Popular Demand. The year before that was called Here Today, Gone Tomorrow. And this year's show will be called Paul and Debbie Get Intimate. And it will be done in small venues, a la Malini, who never big venues. And it will be 200 seaters tops.
Now, will that be around the UK? You're going to travel abroad, or what are your plans?
The UK based. And, then, and that whole show, including, because I do like to carry stage dressings and that, will fit in the back of my, we call them a state car. You call them a station wagon.
Yeah. Station wagon, right. Well, over there in the UK, of course, you have a lot more venues than we do, I think, in the States over here for those kinds of shows. I mean, you have the older nightclub type of things that still have a 100 to 200 seat theater.
We have proper miniature theaters.
Yes.
We do indeed. But equally over here, we have village halls, and because of the state lottery, they've been fitted out now with good lighting and everything, so you can go and do them, and you're not going to come home with a fortune, but you're going to come home with about $2,000.
Yeah,
net.
Have a little bit of a profit there.
Yeah.
You had mentioned Luis de Matos a little bit earlier, and I know that you'd been involved with EMC, Central Magic Conference, and you had a which those 3 years, those conventions or conferences were great. I was watching that live every time. And there's a DVD you have out now. Is a Rivara, or what is it?
Well, when I was 28, I finalized my act. Most pros have got an act they do all the time everywhere. If you are a professional working in one town, you have to keep changing your material. Mm-hmm. But if you're a traveling pro, you can work forever if you've got a great act.
Exactly.
And in many magic magazines now and many books, I'm honored to say that they say I came up with the greatest cabaret act of all time. This cabaret act can work theaters, circuses, anywhere, you know? Yes, it's based on comedy. But on Bravura, I tell you how I arrived at the comedy. I tell you how every trick works in great detail. I tell you why, as opposed to just not just how it works, but why it works. And Bravura was based on my love of Sammy Davis Jr., who came over here and did some shows on television, did two shows, two nights, and said to the director of BBC television at the end, "You do realize you've just recorded my life." And so I realized that Ali had died, and Gil had died, and sometimes I'm looking for the answer to a mystery, and the probe has died and not left it or written it or said it, you know?
Right.
But others have gone on and guessed, but not the real guts of it, you know?
Right, right.
And so I thought, I'm 76 now. I know I don't look it. Thank you, fans. But I just thought it was time to lay it all down so it didn't disappear. It's conceited possibly, but it's too damn good to let it go.
Is it a one DVD set, two, or how many hours?
I think there's four on the set. I might be wrong. There might be three, but I think it's four.
Yeah.
Four on the set. I've never watched it because I know what's on it.
Yeah.
And there's interviews on there, that go much more deeply into performance. Mm-hmm. The first one is the performance of the act. And then from then on it develops. Debbie gets interviewed about being an assistant because there's an awful lot more to that than people think. And stuff like that, you know.
Right.
I'm very proud of it, and several times magicians have said to me, this is the greatest book that's never been written. You know.
And, yeah, since it's not going to be in writing, it's all right there in visual, and of course with the interviews, I think that that's a good way of putting it out.
Then you get much more of a feeling of what I'm talking about.
Right, right.
I'm against pure performance explanations of magic. But this thing goes much deeper than that. It's much more as to why. If you just watch the performance and the how, boom, you will copy the guy doing it. This tells you to not do that. This tells you to think for yourself. It teaches you how to think.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I've always said that if a picture is worth 1,000 words, then a performance really is worth 1,000 demonstrations. So that way they can continue to live on, certainly. Is this the kind of thing, by the way, Bravura, that you're going to be talking about coming up at the Magi Fest later this month?
I have no idea.
No. You're just going to show up and say, what am I doing, Josh?
That tends to be me, yes.
Yeah.
I tend to turn up at places and ask, how long can I see the venue?
Yeah, yeah.
And then, and I don't really do, yes, I suppose it's part lecture, but mostly I like Q&As where I can then nail something that somebody's really interested in.
Mm-hmm. You get a feel of the audience and are able to address their questions because each one's a little bit different, each venue, I'm sure.
Indeed. I've just been to, Italy, which I believe is going to be a fabulous FISM.
Are you coming this year?
I'm going to host something at FISM this year.
Good. I will be there myself.
Well, I'll look forward to seeing you.
We'll have a martini together.
Don't forget me.
Oh, Debbie, you're invited too.
Yeah. Thank you.
Said the voice from the kitchen. Anyway, and so so what it is, I went this year because they gave me the Golden Grolla Award. It's an award they have in Italy. And so, the guy that ran that, is running FISM, and I'm telling you, you could not have a better organizer.
Mm-hmm.
He's something special. I just can't remember his name, Debbie. Could you remember that ugly man we met in Italy? Yes. She's in love with him. That's why I'm saying this. Walter is one good guy, I tell you. Yeah.
Yes. That should be a very good convention. Now you're going to be, again, coming over to the Magi Fest that you're going to be the guest of honor. Last year, as I recall, Juan Tamariz, I think, was the guest. So, you know, high company indeed that you're going to be following.
Well, he actually came to me many a long year ago and asked me how to work on television.
Juan Tamariz?
Yeah.
He
knew his closer than possibly his theater scene. But he had no concept of how to work on television. And it was interesting. One night I'm sitting at home and the phone rang and this voice comes on. Hello, Paul. Siegfried here. And I thought it was somebody taking the mickey, we say. And it really was Siegfried. And he said, Roy and I, we are going to do a talk show, but we don't know what to do.
And so we thought we'd call you.
Yeah. So if you have not enjoyed Siegfried and Roy or Juan on television, it's my fault.
Interesting. Well, great. Listen, we've covered a lot of things some fabulous stories, and I sincerely appreciate the time that you've given. And the title of my podcast, of course, is called The Magic Word, and I always like to get a piece of advice or some sort of motto or something that a person believes in. You know, what is your magic word or phrase? What's something that is important to you?
Never leave your money in the dressing room.
I learned that advice 20 years ago. That's a good one.
And another piece of advice I got from a big, big star when I was just climbing the ladder. He said to me, when I was a young man, I got this piece of advice from a big star. So I'm passing it on to you. I said, what's that? He said, never make love to anybody unless they've got as much to lose as you have.
I think I'm safe.
Yeah.
Very good. Yeah, exactly. Well, listen, best to you and Debbie. Thanks again for being on the Magic Word.
It's been a real pleasure.
Indeed. And so for the Magic Word podcast, that was Paul Daniels. This is Scotty out. My sincere thanks goes out to Paul Daniels for taking the time away from helping his wife Debbie in tearing down the Christmas decorations on the 12th night. It was great that he took all the time we wanted to talk about his life and times. I hope you enjoyed the stories and the podcast. If you'd like to learn more about Paul, then I suggest you purchase his DVD set, Bravura, where you can get all the instructions you need to create your own legacy. And while we're thanking people, I want to especially thank both Hugh Knight, known as Professor Hugh Dini, and John McGrath for being ongoing supporters and patrons of The Magic Word. You can learn more about how you can help by visiting www.patreon.com/themagicword. Patreon is spelled P-A-T-R-E-O-N. There you can view a short 2-minute clip I recorded that tells you all about it. Be sure to like us on Facebook at facebook.com/themagicwordpodcast. So until next time, stay well, get booked, and keep your head up. This is Scotty out.